Mom deserves the best, and there's no better place to shop for Mother's Day than Whole Foods Market. They're your destination for unbeatable savings, from premium gifts to show-stopping flowers and irresistible desserts. Start by saving 33% with Prime on all body care and candles. Then get a 15-stem bunch of tulips for just $9.99 each with Prime. Round out Mom's menu with festive rosé, irresistible berry chantilly cake, and more special treats. Come celebrate Mother's Day at Whole Foods Market.
Mother's Day is around the corner. Find the perfect gift for the mom in your life with a stunning piece of jewelry from Blue Nile. From timeless pearls to dazzling gemstones, Blue Nile has something she'll adore. Need it fast? Most items can ship overnight. Plus, enjoy guaranteed free shipping and returns. Don't miss our special Mother's Day deals. Save big on the season's most beautiful trends. For a limited time, get up to 50% off by going to BlueNile.com. That's BlueNile.com.
Hi, this is Craig Robinson from Ways to Win, and support for this podcast comes from Invesco QQQ, the official ETF of the NCAA. The future isn't scary. Not realizing its potential, however, could be. Just like on the recruiting trail, I've seen potential come in many forms as a coach. Learn more at Invesco.com/QQQ. Let's rethink possibility. Invesco Distributors, Inc.
Hello and welcome to the Motormouth podcast with Harry Benjamin and Tim Sylvie. This is the place where we meet some of the biggest names in and around motorsport, chat about their lives and everything in between. This week we are joined by James William Walker, who you'll know as car YouTuber sensation Mr. JWW, with one of the biggest YouTube platforms in the car world. He joined to chat about his career beginnings, swapping a house deposit for a car, overcoming some speech difficulties, and he even chucked in a couple of exclusives. Thank you so much to you guys who continue to download and listen. If you like it, please do leave us a review. It really helps us to get bigger, and enjoy.
A very warm welcome to episode 30 of the Motormouth podcast. We're recording this on Monday, the 1st of June. Before we introduce today's guest, I have to dive through the airwaves all the way east to the English county of Essex, where I find the man who is not only my fellow podcast presenter, but is now the face of MMTV on YouTube. Yes, we've started releasing weekly videos hosted by my lofty colleague, so make sure you go and check those out. They can also be found on our lovely app, which is available from your app store. We've got various interviews there already with the likes of F1 legend David Coulthard and of course Crofty, the modern day voice of Formula One. We've got opinion pieces and news on global motorsport happenings. Fill your boots, ladies and gents. Right, back to my bearded colleague. Harry, how are you?
I'm very well, Tim. Thank you very much. I've just found out tonight that I'm going to be an uncle.
Aww.
How amazing is that? I know.
Congratulations.
I know. I'm too young to be an uncle, though. I'm not happy about it.
Yeah,
I'm too young.
You get grey hairs soon. That's what kids do to you.
Already got them.
What's been happening?
Apart from that, it's ticking along nicely. Quite possibly the best barbecue in the world on Sunday, literally fully stocked with everything, and it was incredible. My brother did it, so fair play to him. He can really run a barbecue.
Nice. Well, not much news to report here. Obviously, we had some good news recently when we checked the Apple charts for podcasts and found ourselves number four. Sports news category, which is amazing. So the listens continue to go up, and hitting number four is great. Obviously, we want to get to number one, but that's a big achievement for us. I'm very pleased with that. And I think it said on the all-time sports news category, number 10. So yeah. Amazing. Thank you to all our listeners for making that happen. I don't think Harry or I thought we would get that high when we first started out. So many, many thanks to everyone that continues to download. And for those that haven't, go and do it now, please. Right, shall I introduce today's guest?
Let's do it.
James William Walker, otherwise known as Mr. JWW, is an automotive lifestyle and supercar personality and YouTube sensation with over 500,000 subscribers, more than 100 million video views, and hundreds of thousands of social followers. He spends his days driving some of the most incredible and expensive cars on the planet on some ridiculously stunning roads all over the world. He's living every young boy's dream, but it comes with a huge amount of hard work and dedication. Let's dive in and hear all about James. James, welcome to the Motormouth podcast.
I like this.
And a round of applause. How are you getting on, James? Thanks for coming on. How is lockdown life, this whole new world we're living in, treating you?
The new norm.
Well, thanks so much for having me on. Do you know, it's funny, some days I wake up completely distraught at the fact that I've got to face another day of lockdown. But by and large, actually, I think, funnily enough, I and many others will probably look back on this actually quite fondly because we've had amazing weather. I'm 16 months into being a dad, so I've been able to be full-time dad, which is incredible.
Yeah.
And, I mean, my usual lifestyle in terms of travel is ridiculous. I did 80 flights last year. Oof. And this year I'll be lucky to do 10. So yeah. I'm actually at home, enjoying my own home. Weather's been great. I'm exercising more than I ever have done, but I'm making up for it and eating pretty poorly. And all in all, it's not too bad. But I don't want to sort of dismiss, obviously, the severity of the situation and why we are in it. But for me personally, I'm in the middle of the countryside, in the middle of nowhere. And if it wasn't for reading the news, I wouldn't know.
Yeah, yeah. Similar for me. How's it affected the channel? I mean, obviously, you haven't been able to get out there as much as you normally would. I mean, normally, you'd probably be out there every day. Does it have an impact on YouTube's algorithms and all that kind of stuff?
I mean, my channel has turned into the YouTube equivalent of Dave. It's just reruns.
Right.
So I... You know, when this thing started, I was like, oh, I'm not sure how long this is going to go on for. It'll be all right. You know, I'll just do some behind the scenes stuff. And then after a while, I thought, okay, this is actually going on for much longer than anticipated. And I thought, I'm really going to have to think outside the box here, because you're right, Tim. The algorithms need feeding.
Yeah.
They are this hungry beast, and there is no mercy. And unless you feed the beast, they generally spank you. So I think, okay, how do I come up with some content which isn't just utter drivel? So I ended up, I went through my videos and I organized them based on the most views first.
Yeah.
And then I worked my way through those in most viewed order, telling behind the scenes stories and untold stories of those videos and how they came to be.
Yeah.
So I just thought the ones with the most views, I assume are inherently the most interesting. So why don't I go back and set some further context? And it was actually amazing because I keep everything I film, every single file I've ever filmed. I've got these like ridiculous amounts of terabytes and hard drives. And I sort of went back down in the archives and I found all of this unshared footage and B-roll and stuff, which I'd never shared. So it was nice, actually. I ended up, my favorite edit, which I managed to pull out of the bag, I'll preface this with all of the bits to camera that I've been doing have been against my kitchen wall for 8 weeks, which has been ridiculous. But I put together an hour and 15 minute long special of driving a McLaren F1 across Europe, which actually happened 2 years ago. And my channel has doubled in size since then. So there was a huge amount of the audience which never even knew I did that. So it was really nice to go back and share that one.
That's nice. Let's just go back in time a little bit.
Yeah.
Where did this passion for cars come from? Was it always there as long as you can remember? Or was there a specific time in your life that made you go, oh my God, that this is the space I want to be in?
It's always been there. I've always had a fascination. If it had an engine and wheels, I was always interested in it. My uncle, he is still actually a classic Aston Martin restoration specialist. And my first work experience was at his shop installing starter motors on DB4s, DB5s. My granddad was a classic car salesman, and my dad did a short amount of racing in Formula Ford.
Mm.
So it's always sort of been in the family. My household as well was the sort of household that always had some sort of motorsport on TV. I grew up with no shared interest in any sort of ball sports at all. So I was probably the only person in my class at school that, you know, Beckham could kick me in the face and I wouldn't know who it was. I think from an early age, there was always this interest in cars, but I never knew that it would have the impact it did. And actually, I was actually into motocross bikes first. So when I grew up a bit, around about the age between, I'd say 15 up to 20, I used to race. So I'd race KX 125 motocross bikes, got beaten up pretty badly doing that. And then the weirdest thing I did was race quad bikes. I'm not sure if you've ever watched that. Race quads are
Dangerous. Sounds dangerous.
It makes motocross look safe. Ridiculous. But I just thought, oh, it's got four wheels.
Like, but they're so unstable, aren't they?
They're so unstable.
I've driven a couple, and they scare you as well, they can. If you go over a bump.
Oof. Yeah, yeah. Oh, they're nuts. But they're not like a sort of ATV. It's not like a sort of agricultural farm quad. These things are so low. They've got extended A-arms and big diffs, which make them really low and wide. But obviously, versus a motocross bike, they're like twice as heavy. They fall out of the sky pretty sharpish. And when they land on you, something's definitely breaking.
Yeah.
And so that happened a few times. And I thought, I'm going to pack this in. And it was around about the same time I was learning to drive. And then as soon as I passed my test, I mean, quads and motocross bikes were just at the back of my mind. And that was it. I never looked back, really.
And what was your first car? I suppose it set the barrier for everything.
It was a 2003 Mini Cooper. It was black with a white roof. And
classy.
Yeah, I went through three gearboxes in that car.
Lad.
Turns out, even though it was at that time, I think it was a BMW owned at that time, even still. And turns out the first new Minis had Peugeot gearboxes in them. And I went through three of these. I guess I was just either really bad at driving or my heel and toe was probably atrocious. So I was like slamming gears in and stuff. But yeah, I went through three boxes. It was the car that I had my first crash in, two crashes in fact. I actually tried to buy it back a few years ago, but it turned out someone else had its third crash and
Gutted. We should do some car roasting. Have you seen those videos that the Top Gear boys are doing over on Drive Tribe where they roast YouTubers' cars? I don't know if yours has been on it, but it was. So I think they did Sam as well. They've done one or two others. But Harry, what was your first car?
My first car was a Ford Fiesta 1.2 in red.
There's nothing you can say about that.
I'm onto a Nissan Qashqai though, so I don't know if that's even cooler. Or my dad has a Porsche, so we're good there. What was your first car then? I've never actually known.
So I had a Citroen AX 4-speed manual box, and followed by a car that I reckon James, one of the few cars that I don't think James would have heard of, which is a Subaru Vivio. You heard of that?
I actually haven't. No,
it's a tiny, tiny little thing. I mean, it's minute. I don't even know. They won't make them anymore. That was a manual box with a four-wheel drive button on the gear lever. No. 600 cc, something like that. Yeah. Struggled to get up hills.
Wow.
Yeah.
Well, James, humble beginnings for you, obviously, with that first car. If we went out to your driveway into your garage now, what would we discover?
It's a little bit boring at the minute. I'm going through a bit of a mix-up at the moment. I am still the owner of a Ferrari F12 TDF.
Yeah, that's boring.
It's not on my driveway. It's not on my driveway because I recently put it up for sale, actually.
Oh, yes, I saw.
Yeah, which is sad. It's mostly sad because 2020 was supposed to be the year that I absolutely rinsed that thing. But for obvious reasons, everything that was planned with it has been completely canned.
Yeah.
So I've got this car, which I put disproportionate amount of my savings into it, just sat on the drive with no plans at all. So I thought, well, the chances are I'm not going to get to use it anytime soon. I did some great things with it in 2019, entered it into the Targa Florio rally, and drove it around Sicily, and drove it up Mount Etna as well, which is great content from that. But that is now residing in the storage of DK Engineering. So those guys have currently got that for sale. But there is still a manual Porsche GT3, 991.2 GT3, and the family car, which is a Porsche Macan Turbo.
Very nice.
Which I'm enjoying it. It's a great car. It's good fun. So
the Porsches are so hard to keep up with, aren't they, with their numbers. A friend of mine, Darren, I'll give him a little hat tip, Darren Andrew, he's got a Porsche and he knows them all. But it must be quite challenging to get your head around all these different types of car.
It's endless. Yeah. I mean, even still, I mean, the 991 generation of Porsche, obviously that's been discontinued now, but that was around for 7 years. And even when I type the letters 991 in my titles, I always get people commenting going, don't you mean 911?
Yeah.
You know, so it's 991 is the generation.
Right.
And 911 is the model. So 911 would always exist, but it'd always be prefaced with 997, or at the minute, the current generation is 992. And the list goes back and back and back. So yeah, complex. And then halfway through the product life, they then facelift them and it's a Gen 2 or Dot 2. And then they do an RS version.
God, it's crazy.
It's crazy. It's ridiculous. Yeah. So the longest version of late is the Porsche 911 GT3 RS Generation 2 Wyzak.
Oh, Wyzak.
Catchy. Oh, yeah,
very catchy. Wyzak. Rolls off the tongue. Yeah.
This is really going to come in handy for the quiz later that I've lined up for you. So it's good that you know the full length of these ridiculous cars. But YouTube, let's talk about that, because that is where you've made your mark, Mr. JWW. Let's go right back to the beginning. What made you want to start a YouTube channel? You know, what was life like just before you were gearing up to take on and become a YouTuber?
So I'll take you back even further, because I think it sets a spot of context. So when I was at school, and don't worry, this won't be a 2-hour chat.
It's okay. Harry's editing skills are excellent.
Yeah, how far back are we going?
I used to film me and my friends skiing and snowboarding. That's where the appreciation and love for film came. I'll also preface it, and this might be an exclusive for you, actually, because I haven't actually ever told this story. So when I was growing up, I actually had quite a bad stutter. Like, I couldn't say my own name, in fact. It was really bad. And I had all sorts of speech therapy and all sorts of things that didn't work at all. And it wasn't until I found the world of being able to edit that it was the first time that I had control of my voice before anyone else heard it, right? So my love for film and editing actually came before the cars. It was an opportunity for me to create something, edit it, and it be able to go to the outside world in a way that I always wanted it to. But at the time when I was growing up and I was a teenager, I mean, I was the guy at school who had sick notes to excuse me from doing any sort of standing up in front of class or any sort of speeches. Not because it was embarrassing, because the assembly would be there for 3 hours while I sort of stuck through it all. And so I found this love for film because I could finally create and say how I would like things to be said. The amazing thing about that is I had this psychological switch when I pulled the camera up to my face to start talking, because I knew I had control over it. My stutter at that time, I wouldn't say vanished, but it went like 80%. It just sort of went. And so the editing journey, which is a story I've never shared with my audience even, is much more important to me than people might think.
Yeah,
because
that's amazing.
It literally transformed my life.
Yeah.
I was, you know,
that is amazing.
The day I couldn't go into a shop and order something. Like it was that bad. Yeah.
And how old were you around this time?
Growing up completely all the way up.
Yes.
When I started editing, it was probably around about 16.
Right.
16, 17, 18 when I was doing this, it was just completely changed things. And so my love for it is way deeper than people actually think. So that's how that started. But during that period at school where it was the odd skiing and snowboarding trip, let's go and film that. Me and my friends all passed our driving test, and then that was it. Forget skiing. Let's film cars. Now, at that time, there's no YouTube. If we think Facebook really is 2004. Mm. So 2004 is when I passed my driving test. And I think at that time, Facebook was even still restricted to universities then. So there was no real video platform at that time. So what I was doing was burning it onto CDs and giving it to five of my mates and going, wasn't that fun? You know, that was it. That's completely where it stopped. Then I went to uni, didn't do any more filming then, really. Started this is as nerdy as it comes, but I started a video gaming web comic where I would write comic strips and that would take the piss out of the video gaming world at that time. And me and a friend of mine from uni did that. It eventually got sponsored by Nintendo. I thought I was going to be a millionaire. That didn't happen. And then left uni, joined the real world for about 10 years. And then this is where it gets nuts. Saved up a deposit for my first house and decided to blow it all on an Audi R8.
As you do.
Yeah. And at that point, it was like, okay, family's going to disown me here. What are you doing?
Is this, you're presumably at this point, you are with the wife?
No. At this point, I am single.
Right. So no one to answer to, no one to go, what the hell are you doing, you mad person?
And that was the whole reason behind it, right? I sort of worked and saved. And those, I think, you know, when you're growing up, particularly in England, it's get on the property ladder, you know, et cetera, et cetera. And I got to the point where I looked around this house for like third time. And I knew that day that I was going to confirm on this house. And I walked in this door and I stood in the lounge and something just went in my head. I was like, this ain't happening. I can't take this on a track day. You know? And the Audi R8, the first gen, the 2009 car, had launched. For me, the Audi R8 was one of those few cars that, aesthetically at least, really made the industry stand to attention. Because it was like, hold on a minute. You've got this company, Audi, who's basically known for building good quality reps cars. All of a sudden has like shown the supercar industry how to build a supercar and arguably as well how to make them look. And it was just so out there, so abstract. And it pulled up my heartstrings way more than the concept of buying this house. And so I went out and I blew the deposit on this car.
That was exceedingly reckless.
Exceedingly reckless. And any young people who are watching this planning on buying their first house and are into cars, I'm not condoning this situation in any shape or form. In fact, it's the only one example of hindsight in my life that has worked out because that's the car which opened the doors to the car world for me. So when you get a nice car, you feel that you're more justified going on interesting road trips with, you know, other nice cars. You're going on track days, you're going to car meets, joining car clubs, etc. And through that, it was the induction to the car world, which I always wanted. And that's when I started to write a blog, actually. I didn't film at first. I started to write a blog. The reason being, filming takes so long, and I'm no doubt we'll speak about that shortly. But I still had a full-time job, and I was thinking, okay, at the weekend, which is the only time I can use this car, I'll take some nice photos and I'll write a blog and then hopefully people will read about that. And that's how it started. And it wasn't for a long time after that I started filming cars.
Wow.
Yeah.
Wow.
And then when did the transition from writing about cars into filming cars come about? And did you do I can't remember who we were talking to, whether it was Sam or someone else who right back in their early days of YouTube would film outward and not film themselves and film the vehicles. And then there came a point where they turned the camera around and started talking into the camera. Were you the same? Did you start in that fashion?
No, I started camera facing first. And I think that was a combination of, I mean, if you look at the YouTubers out there in this field, I'm still the last to that party.
Yeah.
I've been doing it, I think I've been doing it a year less than Sam. But compared to like Paul Wallace and Shmi, like Paul's been doing it for 12 years, I think.
Yeah.
Tim's in his 10th year. I'm just starting my fifth year now. And because I was so late to it, I'd been watching other people's content and they'd already started speaking to the camera. But also, I was a big fan of, you know, watching Evo content, the likes of, you know, Dickie Meaden and Jethro Bovingdon and Chris Harris. These guys were already speaking to camera. And I knew the content, which I really enjoyed watching. And it wasn't people behind the camera just pointing it at cars driving by. It was trying to come up with the most descriptive words possible to put the audience in the driver's seat.
Yeah.
And so it was pretty much from day one, actually. Yeah.
And those other YouTubers, you know, the likes of Paul, Sam, Seb Delaney, and so on, this world that you came into a bit later, did they welcome you with open arms? I mean, you're all very close now. You filmed together some of the time. You know, how was it when you first came on the scene?
Yeah, it was great. It was brilliant. I mean, you know, we all often refer to it, in fact, as the sort of good old days, because, you know, everyone now has very much gone off in their own ways. But when it first started, you know, what was great about it was everyone was feeding off each other. We were cross-pollinating audiences. We were doing joint videos where part A would be on someone else's channel and part B would be on someone else's channel, and there was challenges. We would go on an annual road trip every year. It was like, okay, every April, go down to Top Marks, Monaco. That was the like kickstart of the car season. And everyone was just so pumped for it, you know? And I think at that time, it was still so new and none of us really knew where it was going. I mean, I was probably doing it for a good 2.5 years before I knew that I could do it full time. So everything I was doing, even though I had a commercial mind on for the long run, the interim and short-term period on the run-up to that was very much, well, the chances are this isn't going to be a big deal, so I just want to make the most of it as I can and just have as much fun as I can with some incredible cars. And so at that time, we were, myself, Paul, Sam and Seb in particular used to team up a lot. Shmi dipped in every now and again. And it was, it was a great vibe. It was, in fact, Tim, Shmi, who was like, when are you going to get a camera out and start filming stuff? So I've probably known Tim quite a few years prior to me actually starting to film things. And I joined him on the collection of his McLaren 675 LT. And he said to me at that time, he was like, oh, you know, if you're going to do it, now's the time. You know, try and get some big cars for your first video and just go for it. So I did. And then I saw Sam Fame from Seen Through Glass and Paul Wallace from Supercars of London. We were at, what's that car show? Salon Privé.
Yeah. Mm.
And this is off the back of a road trip where I crossed paths with them a few months prior. And we were like, oh, how's it going? Everything cool? He's like, yeah, I'm thinking about doing this YouTube thing. They're like, yeah, just do it. What's the worst that can happen? Just do it. And now it's my entire life. It's full-time work. Haven't had a proper job for 5 years.
Yeah.
So
when you put yourself out there on, you know, such a big platform, you inevitably open yourself up to, you know, lots of comments and YouTube comments and social media comments. Have you had to deal with any sort of, you know, negative comments or dealing with having that increased social presence? Is that something you've taken to quite well, or have you sort of muddled your way through and learning that whole sort of almost like a different world, really?
Yeah, man. I mean, you know, anyone who's spent any amount of time in the comment section of YouTube knows it can be a pretty dark place.
Yeah.
I was really fortunate, and this wasn't a strategic thing. It's just the way it played out. When I first started the channel, this game is all about regular content, always. Just connect what's the next video. And I would often get a lot of inspiration for what the next video might be by reading the comments, because people, in between the "you're a moron" post, it would be "we'd love to see this" or "can we see that" or "what about this?" So I would scroll through, and in the very early days when I could get back to everyone, I did. I used to reply to every single comment. The theme being, if you asked a decent question, you would get a decent answer. And after a while, I think me getting back to people with like lengthy, decent like feedback, the audience at that time begin to understand that if their input was good, they would get something good back. And I think with hindsight, this is one of the reasons where I'm quite fortunate that for a long time, the audience is too big now. Like there's no avoiding it. But for quite a long time, the majority of the audience was very mature. And every now and again, even now, when someone chirps in with like a pretty bad comment, I don't have to do anything because the audience who's there just squashes them down.
Yeah.
And that is hindsight legwork. It was never planned out like that. But thankfully, as far as comment sections go, mine isn't too dark. Yeah. Sometimes it's horrendous and you want to throw yourself out of a top window, but generally it's fine.
Yeah. And you've had this journey, you've built up your subscriber base, chucked out loads and loads of videos, and recently you started Project 4.
Yeah.
Tell us about your bunker and your racetrack on your doorstep. How did this come about?
So, the reason it's called Project 4 is I set myself a goal of every year on the channel doing at least one big thing. And because thing isn't a very descriptive word for a project, I decided calling these things projects. And half of the strategy on YouTube is the tease. It's the build-up. It's the awareness. It's what's coming next, right? And so calling projects Project 1, Project 2, Project 3, etc. was, okay, I've started the legwork on Project 4. Something big is coming, you know? And that's where these project statuses started. Project 4, as it would suggest, is the fourth one of these pretty major projects. The idea was that I never start a video from my own house. I've always kept my personal life offline, mostly because it's a car channel and I'm not like, this is what I had for lunch.
You're not
today
a transformer.
Like that. It's just not that fun. So because I've never started a video from home, I've never had a base of which to do a walk and talk around the car that isn't an empty lay-by or an abandoned car park, which we all know empty lay-bys are never empty for long. Mm. And abandoned car parks look crap. So every time I would start a video, I'd be walking around it and some motorbike would blast past and like cock up that take, or the backdrop just looked nasty. I remember, and it was this point I was like, I need to address this. The only place I could find, because these cars that you drive, they're never on your doorstep. They're anywhere but. I remember borrowing a 360 Challenge Stradale at the beginning of last year. And the only place I could find was a lay-by with like a skip in the background that's full of abandoned trash. And I did the juxtaposition between a 360 Challenge Stradale
and
this
skip.
Glamorous brand that I'm trying to build and this like skip with this crap falling out of it. So I was like, I need a base, man. So Project 4 was all about, I need a JWWHQ in which to begin reviews from. And so the idea was really at first to just have a studio. The thought of having my own racetrack was never part of the equation. I mean, who does that, right? Who goes, do you know what I need? It's my own studio. And basically I need Top Gear.
Yeah.
And then as I started to look for studios, I came across a place called Bicester Heritage. Anyone who's never been to or heard of Bicester Heritage, it is a World War II. In fact, it might actually date back to World War I, but certainly World War II base.
It's World War I. It is World War One. Yeah.
World War, wow. Yes, and it's an airfield. So it has an outfield of that airfield, and outfields are great for cars. So they had a space there on site. So I am in an old ammunition store, which is cool as cool anyway. So the whole thing is like exposed brick, and it's got so much history and character. Backdrop's beautiful. There's all gorgeous trees and old military buildings. So I don't have to park a Ferrari next to a skip anymore. The bonus was they've got this. Basically, it's an outfield, but it can double as a circuit. And no one's really using it. There are other people on there. So Bicester Heritage has curated this amazing place where everyone who has rented buildings there is in some way associated with cars, the majority of them restoring classic cars. And the most that track really gets used is when somebody has rebuilt a Bentley blower. They go out and do a shakedown lap, make sure it's cool, and then that's it. And so I was like, well, if I can get in there and negotiate use of that track, I've got a studio with a track on my doorstep. And that, signed the deal on that in December 19. after wow. parking the 360 by a skip in. I think it was February 19. By the end of the year, it was done. And here I am with a studio on a
perfect
A-track circuit.
So you basically have created your own Top Gear.
Yeah.
Inadvertently, I now have my own Top Gear, yeah.
That's so cool.
It's funny because I never even thought about it at that time. It was just like, oh, putting these two and two together sounds cool. And then when I announced it, everyone was just like, oh, you've gone and got yourself your own Dunsfold. Yeah, right.
Yeah.
That's pretty cool.
That's not bad at all. Okay, I've got a question for you. Two-part question. And give me the first part of the question in no particular order, with not a favourite first. So first part of the question, your three-car garage. Go. Ultimate three-car garage.
Mate, this is like, how would you do that to a car guy? That's I mean, I get, you're evil, man.
The second part's even worse.
Okay, so three-car garage. The first car, I'm going to say, is a little bit subjective because it doesn't strictly exist yet. But we know it'll be here. But the Aston Martin Valkyrie has a bit of me written all over it. It strikes me as being our this generation's McLaren F1. And, you know, a car designed by Adrian Newey.
Yeah, it's always going to be special.
One of Formula One's greatest, if not the greatest aerodynamicist, certainly sets me alight. And the fact that it has a naturally aspirated V12 that revs to 10 also that does well. Fun fact around that car, you would be in the top 10 qualifying times of the Formula One grid last year on road tires.
Jesus
with that car.
Christ,
so
that's insane.
That will be interesting. And then
that's a video waiting to happen.
Yeah, yeah. That'll be part of the plan for next year.
Nice.
And then the other one, McLaren F1 LM, I would say. I would say GTR, but I like the LM is still for the road, but track bias. That would be cool. Obviously, fantastic history there and et cetera. And then I know there's lots of other hypercars and stuff out there, but you've got to have a Porsche 911 in there.
Yeah.
And for me, a manual GT3 is pretty good. That ticks lots of boxes.
Yeah, I think that'll be a popular choice.
You're going to hate the next part of this.
Second part of the question, you've got to give two of them back.
What?
What would you keep?
Who does that? Okay, I'm going to give back the Valkyrie and the GT3 because this is the only reason, because the McLaren F1 has three seats, so it's still remotely practical.
You can get the kid in there. The wife is perfect. Yeah, yeah, go shopping. I don't know how much of a boot it's got. I don't know how much of a boot it's got for the shopping.
Why do you know? There's like side pods that fall out of the F1 and they've got like bespoke baggage that's made for them.
There you go.
I managed to do a week-long road trip in a McLaren F1 with my bags in the F1. So it's not bad.
What have you driven then, or what have you not driven that you would like to drive then? I suppose it's the Valkyrie.
That's a cool question, man. Well, let's talk about cars that actually are driving.
That exist. Yes, let's put that. That, yeah, there you go.
Not quite strictly there yet. That's a good question, actually. Car that, this is, I've never driven a Ferrari F50. I would love to drive an F50. Yeah, not experienced one of those yet. It was supposed to be part of this year's content plan, but obviously
out the window.
Things have been set back. I started a series, which was Project 2, actually, which was the Modern Classics series. And season 2 was this year. I think it will still happen, but an F50, it's certainly on the cards there.
Nice. And we've mentioned YouTubers galore so far, but do you have a best buddy out of all of them?
Best buddy?
Bearing in mind, they all do listen to this week in, week out, so...
you know what? The Sam and Paul combo is great. I mean, I know that's a cop-out answer, but I do enjoy it when the three of us go on our little hot hatch tour, style videos. That's good fun. And I think everyone's personalities and backgrounds are so different that it makes for a really great time.
Yeah.
You know, both on camera and off. I think it's, so that combo.
Yeah.
So, Paul Fane.
Paul Fane. Now, very important part of the interview here, my friend. This is the bit I've been looking forward to because, as you know, we've had Seen Through Glass, Sam, on the show. He took part in our quiz, Motormouth. So I shall hand over to my esteemed colleague to introduce you to the hardest quiz in motorsport. Over to you, Harry, old boy.
Yes. Cue music, Mr. JWW James. Welcome to Motormouths, the hardest quiz in motorsport. And we have a grid technically of over 20 guests so far making up the leaderboard. At the moment, Martin Plowman is at the top with 13 points, just ahead of Brendan Hartley. Seen Through Glass, you'll be pleased to hear, is 15th on the leaderboard. He scored 9 points. So basically, this is how it works. I've got four clips to play you, and every game changes depending on the guest we have. So every question is about you. And I've gone through your YouTube, and I have taken a few clips from various videos and put them out of context. And I would like you to then please put them into some context for some points, basically. And if you can get the full title, as you have labeled it, of the YouTube video, that is also a point. There's four of them, and then a bonus question. Are you ready for your first clip?
Go on.
We thought it'd be unfair to give you hardcore Formula One questions at this point. You know, I think this is what this. We probably only had one or two that haven't been motorsport necessarily related. So you're already in a good position here. Right, Harry, James, here comes clip number one.
This is my family daily driver shopping car, everything to everyone. I beat this thing and it's not really looked after.
Okay, an easy one to start off with?
Yeah.
Yeah, I think so. So do you need the context?
So what are you talking about first?
Right, so that is talking about cleaning my Porsche Macan, which, as I mentioned in the video, is our family car. It is heavily neglected, unlike the other cars that I feature on the channel. It's often covered in dirt and grime. But I took it to NVN London. That is a sort of paint protection film and detailing place, which I'm involved in. And we have recently introduced a cleansing strategy that involves the use of ozone gas.
Yes.
I believe the title of the video is...
Here we go.
This is the hard bit.
Disinfecting my Porsche Macan Turbo.
It's close.
I'm going to give you that. It wasn't disinfecting. It was decontaminating. Okay. But you're pretty much there. You're pretty much there. All right. That's a solid start. That is 3 points on the board so far. So you're already not last. You're already ahead of Karun Chandhok, who did appallingly.
Shameful performance from him. All
right, Tim, let's have clip number two.
Here it comes.
6.3 litre naturally aspirated V12 connected to a twin clutch 7-speed automatic gearbox, putting it into sport, and importantly,
that's all you get.
Now, so what are you talking about there? Can you think of the car you're talking about?
There's quite a few cars with a naturally aspirated V12 mated to a 7-speed twin clutch gearbox. Putting it into sport would suggest that it's a Ferrari. Is it a Ferrari Lusso?
Yes.
Lusso? Yes, absolutely.
Okay, so I've driven a few of these, though.
Can you get a little hint? It's one of the more recent videos. Right.
So it's Ferrari GTC4 Lusso V12. Time to buy my next daily driver.
Absolutely spot on. Yes.
The more we do this quiz, the more tense it gets. Honestly, it's giving me heart palpitations.
That's another 3 points in the bag. If you get another three in this next one, you'll be level with Sam. So it's all to play for at the moment. Right, clip number three, please.
Here we go.
Granted, under circumstances I didn't expect until this time next year. So I'll be straight up front here. When I originally bought this car, I did sort of lay out for myself a 3-year ownership plan.
Yeah. This one is quite recent. So, in fact, we spoke about this at the beginning of
We did indeed.
That is the video where I am explaining why I'm doing the controversial move of putting my F12 TDF up for sale.
Yes.
The title of it is My Ferrari F12 TDF is for sale.
Is there anything else to that, do you think?
Here's why.
Yes. Absolutely. Wow. Okay. You're level. You're level with Sam now. So the only way is up. The only way is up. Okay.
Great, final tune.
Clip for you. And then we've got a bonus question. But here's your final clip.
I like this one because you can hear an engine.
So there's been a few occasions lately where I'm quite literally stuck for words.
And that's it. You're quite literally stuck for words.
I mean, I've driven some cars, but
this one's pretty out there. Oh, that said too much.
Oh, lads, this is difficult. This is difficult. Okay, so
hardest quiz in motorsport.
Do I get any form of clue on this, or can I ask a question that might prompt something?
Okay, you can ask a question.
Question, yeah, go on.
Whether we answer it or not is to our discretion.
Okay, that's fine. Does it involve a car that would otherwise not be on the road?
Yes.
So it's an Aston Martin Valkyrie.
No. It is a car that can go on the road.
Okay.
But it's a...
Whether it's road legal or not. It is. Oh, it is, okay.
But you wouldn't ordinarily see it on the road.
Okay. Is it an Aston Martin Vulcan?
No.
No, I'm out then. I don't know.
Oh, no. Come on. You can get... We'll give you one last chance.
I'll give you one more clue. You get one clue. You've asked the question, now you get one clue. So this... in the title of the video, and I'm pretty sure is how long ago the video is, it dates back to 2016.
It gets a lot of attention.
Good God. Okay, that is going far. Okay, 2016. What was bonkers in 2016?
And it is bonkers. It's completely bonkers.
Okay, so this is the carbon fiber Batmobile.
He's onto it.
Mate, I can't recall titles from 2016. This is nuts.
Any guesses?
It's something like Team Gehlag Batmobile Gumball 3000, something like that.
You know what? I'm going to give you the point for that. I'm not going to give you the full three points.
No, can't give him the full 3 points.
I'm going to give you 2 points. I'm going to give you two for that.
That so didn't
that's a solid effort.
Didn't Seb Delaney crash that? I don't want to bring up old. But
Seb did. Sorry, Seb. Yeah,
sorry, Seb.
Seb crashed that last year sometime.
Bad times.
He was fine.
Yeah.
Are you ready for your bonus question?
Okay, go on. I like this game. It's cool.
Okay. So as of today, that Gumball video with the Batmobile.
Yeah.
Is your most popular video on your YouTube, but how many views approximately does it have?
I think you'll get this.
It begins, is it 4.2?
Going to take that?
Million. What do you think?
I think that's close enough.
All right, I'll give it to you. 4.3. I'll give it to you.
4.3.
And well, that was very well done. All right, let me just do the maths.
While you're clocking up, the second most popular video was the one in Ras Al Khaimah, right?
That's correct.
That we both did. With Ollie Webb. That was incredible. That road. I think you were I'm pretty sure it's the first time a YouTuber drove and exposed that road.
It's been amazing since then, dude. I'm not sure if you've had any feedback on this, but the amount of car brands which have launched cars there since that is ridiculous.
Yeah, Alfa did it, didn't they?
Yeah, Alfa did it. I know BMW have been there, Rolls have been there, Bentley have been there. Not always, you know, fully open house. They've been there for like photo shoots and things. But yeah, it really put that on the map.
It did. Jebel Jais in Ras Al Khaimah, 30 odd kilometers of unbelievable driving road. Anyway, this
more importantly,
Harry, tell us
where do you think you've come on leaderboard?
So how many?
So there's 13 points up for grabs.
20 people on the board.
20 people on the board. Sam is 15th.
I think you've beaten him. Smashed him.
I'd like to be in the top five.
Ooh, punchy.
Well, there are two leaderboards. There's the overall leaderboard and then the season three leaderboard, which is where we're in season three now.
Okay.
On the overall leaderboard, you have scored, Mr. JWW, 12 points, which puts you third.
Oh, podium.
Overall leaderboard, just below Brendan Hartley and ahead of Ollie Webb.
Hey, yes.
And on the overall season three leaderboard, that puts you second. Point.
Well done.
Martin Plamen. So third overall, second in season three. That is a solid job. Well done.
I like this. Is there going to be some sort of finalists thing?
Well, that's the thing. We're trying to figure that out.
Two people have asked that now.
Yeah. And I feel like perhaps because this is episode 30, it's a round number. Maybe we should do a sort of, you know, a final shootout amongst the top 10 overall.
That'd be cool.
We need to do something.
Clearly, James is up for it, so it's all to play for, really. You're in good company, actually. You've got Ollie Webb, Mark Priestley, Mark Blundell, Jenny Gow, Crofty, Will Buxton, Ola Rowland, Sebastian Buemi, all up there with you. So David, you've even beaten David Coulthard, so not too shabby at all.
F1 royalty. James, let's take your current YouTube self. You're looking back at your 2015 YouTube self. What would you tell 2015 JWW that you could maybe avoid a pitfall or progress quicker or do something different? What would you tell yourself?
Anyone would think you'd have done this before, like 30 times before. Good questions. The first thing I would say is... take the first few years way more seriously because the first few years for me were what exciting cars can I drive this Saturday? That was about it. So if I'd have dedicated more time to it in the first couple of years, I would have progressed things further. And secondly, don't worry if your video gets terrible views because it is old news tomorrow. And every video, you know, the funniest thing is you'll put so much time and effort into filming a video that you think's brilliant, it'll do okay or it'll flatline, but regardless of if it's amazing or brilliant, you guarantee one of the first few comments is what's next.
So
it doesn't really matter. Just move on. So persistence, go harder earlier, and don't worry about views.
Great answer. And obviously, this is essentially a motorsport podcast. I mean, we delve into all sorts of different areas. So we've got to ask you a little bit about motorsport. Formula One, what's your take on Formula One? Is it something you enjoy watching? Do you like the current era? Do you hark back to the good old days through rose-tinted glasses?
Yeah, I do. Sorry, I'm that guy. I am the naturally aspirated era guy. I think I had a... I mean, you know, it's incredibly fortunate experience, but I was very lucky to go to the last naturally aspirated race in Monaco and then the first of the turbocharged races. The last race, I was invited down to the tunnel, inside the tunnel, by the owner of the Fairmont Hotel, which is where the cars, you know, pass underneath. Yeah. And... I was stood next to the marshals, which are basically trackside inside a tunnel. I'm yet this day to have experienced an emotion surrounding a car that I'm not driving, spectating, that has literally given me tingles and goosebumps and made me emotional to the point of it affecting me, you know? And then the following year, it was the polar opposite. I was on... Raskas corner. Once again, had very privileged access. I was on the apex of that corner. It was me and some chicken wire fence between me and the drivers, and they'd gone turbocharged, and it was just like a Dyson coming past. Like I just,
it's a great description.
I was so, it felt like someone had ripped my Formula One heart out. Because it's not that the racing is any worse. In fact, I think last season was actually pretty good. It's that the physical connection between the spectators and the sport is that the engine sound used to vibrate the diaphragm in your chest physically. And so you literally had a tangible connection between the race that you were observing. And I think, you know, that sound and that energy conveyed so much power and so much about, it represented the, that it was the pinnacle of motorsport because it sounded the pinnacle of motorsport. Now the support race sounds better. Yeah. And regardless of if it is or isn't, it's a spectator sport. It's there for entertainment. And I've just lost the true passion, which I did have for it.
I mean, you're
that
not
being said, when those titles come on and I'm watching it at home, it's still top tier. It's still Formula One.
Yeah. Yeah.
And I love, interestingly though, now I enjoy the build up and behind the scenes of the race as much as I do the race itself.
Yeah. It is fascinating. The whole circus is fascinating. Harry, you'll probably know, when did it switch over to, from when did it switch over to the hybrid era? 2014.
Well, actually, I was going to say this has made me think. Actually, it's slightly different. Obviously, I went to my first Grand Prix ever just as a punter in the stands in 2013 to the British Grand Prix, and that was the final year of the V8 engines. And I remember being there, and you could literally not sit. You could be sat far back in the stands, and you still had to have, you know, you had to have earplugs.
Yeah.
You had to. And even if you walked further away, right from the entrance of the gates to Silverstone, they would be, you know, almost deafening. And then since then, I've been back, and I've been lucky enough to work in it on the paddock and actually being on the grid at one point in 2016. And you don't need earbuds. You don't need any of that. And it's just,
you can have a chat. You can have a conversation
as cool as they like, but it's just this. It's not the same.
It was a huge shame when it all changed. I've worked in F1 for 15 years now, showing my age. And I remember when I can't remember the exact year, it was 2013 into 2014, right?
Yeah.
So, and I remember the reaction. Everyone just fell flat. You know, it's just like, this just isn't the same. You don't get the tingly feeling on the back of your neck. The hairs don't stand up. It's just not the same. And they've got a bit louder since, haven't they? But it's a real pity.
You just get used to it, though, after a while, I think. You just learn to sort of live with it.
Yeah. It's not the worst thing you can do is go to the Festival of Speed and hear the old cars.
Unbelievable.
Because it just punches you in the face as to how incredible.
Yeah. Now, of course, you've actually driven a Formula One car back in 2012, wasn't it, in the Lotus Renault car?
The 2012 car.
What was that like then, being actually, you know, in the cockpit for a change and, you know, the V8 and a V8 engine car?
Hey, I can't. This is a podcast in itself, man. No, I'm dead serious. I mean, at some point...
Wow, I bet I can imagine.
...do the chat, but I cried when I stepped out of that car. It was I actually did cry. I'm not afraid to admit that. It was just probably, you know, death without exception, one of the top five life experiences. There's so many facets to this, and at some point we should probably have a chat about it. But I think one of the elements which was highlighted to me the most was, and this might be stating the obvious, the performance of those things is beyond my vocabulary to try and describe to you what is going on with those cars. Car isn't a word you should use with it because it's like... it feels like a science project that just so happens to have wheels.
Yeah.
The downforce, I mean, I've driven some pretty downforce heavy cars. I had to lean my head on the cowling on the second lap because my neck just collapsed.
Yeah.
I had nowhere near the ability to drive the car to, you know, I was probably driving this thing 10%. And I'm just being honest, you know. But one thing I did have the ability to do was press the brakes, and there is no words to describe to you the braking force of a car in its initial bite under full downforce on hot slicks. Is, well, my the bottom of my helmet touched my chest because it forced my face forward so much that I was looking out of the visor like this, you know, like outwards.
Yeah.
I remember the bruising when I came back in, like from the harnesses. When you get in these cars, I mean, it wasn't a case of, hey, just come down and drive a Formula One car. The amount of hoops that I had to jump through in order to do it were fairly substantial. I had to go to some simulator training. Then I had to, I did Paul Ricard. I did 30 laps in a Formula Renault. That was the most of all of the training through the classroom and theory and simulators. The seat time in the Formula Renault was disproportionately the most
valuable
time, because it was a taste of, you know, fairly substantial downforce, but not quite of, you know, Formula levels. But the Renault F1 team, and that was the best part about it, was it was a fully factory-supported experience. It wasn't some dude who owned an old F1 car. This was Kimi Raikkonen's 2012 car. It was the chassis that I think he won Yas Marina with it.
Yeah.
And yeah, it wasn't, I mean, some people were like, oh, they must have down-tuned it. And this, no, it revved to 15,000 RPM and it was at 780 horsepower. And it, you know, it idled at 6,500 RPM. The stuff that really highlighted to me the most was how TV does quite a bad job of conveying to the audience how extreme that sport is. Mm. And I think what is quite interesting is most of the people that communicate this sport to us are ex-F1 drivers. And what you'll find that they do is they'll start talking amongst themselves. And what they say, they express it in a very casual manner. In the, oh, he just braked at 100 yards doing 170 miles an hour. You know what I mean? And to put context into that, the amount of data points that I asked for after it, just to give some sense of context. So in an F1 car, it's left foot braking only. Certainly, I would actually describe it as left leg braking because the amount of force you have to apply through the pedal was the minimum brake pressure that they wanted me to apply. This is every corner. I think Paul Ricard has over 17 corners. Was 65 kilograms of pressure on my left leg alone, every single corner.
It's quite a lot.
And I thought, wouldn't it be great if we could get in some normal person from the crowd, for argument's sake, and go whatever circuit they were at on that given day, say for argument's sake, it had 15 corners, get them in on a leg press with 65 kilogram weight and say, okay, we would like you to bench press all 15 corners for us just on your left leg alone.
Yeah.
And then, okay, and they'll, even if they can do one lap, then multiply that by how many laps you have during that race. That's just one element of it. I mean, you know, I don't think we appreciate.
No.
These guys are ninjas, man. Like, the guys driving these cars are of a different species.
With disproportionately strong left legs. But that's a really interesting point you make about the commentary. I've never thought about the commentary like that before, but now you say it's very true. They do sort of off the cuff, casually just talk about that braking and the speed. Mm-hmm. It'd be nice to have someone there to go, that's ridiculous. Will Buxton, who we had on here a couple of weeks ago, he's quite good at that, you know, because he breaks it down into layman terms in a sort of descriptive fashion. Now, listen, we're running out of time, so we're going to chuck some quick questions at you before we move on to our final three, which we ask everybody. Right, one word answers on these two questions. Formula E, yes or no?
Yes.
Interesting. And is esports or virtual racing a valid form of racing? Yes or no?
No.
Oh, we could delve into that so deeply. I would also like.
I did just chiming in briefly that I did. I was on the phone actually to Nikki Shields earlier today, and we were chatting about what we thought of the virtual e racing on Formula E and Formula One. And as entertaining as it can be, I think we both agreed that it just doesn't do it. You know, it just doesn't do it.
All the drivers are starting to pull out now because they make one little mistake and they lose their real world drive.
There's been so much controversy surrounding that. What I will preface that with is while I don't think it's a valid form of racing, it's a very intense game.
Yeah.
I'm not, darts is a game as well, but it's serious, right? I mean, don't underestimate the skill of the guys who are.
Yeah, the pro sim races, yeah.
These guys are incredible. I think
Daniel App proved that.
Wow. Some drivers are serious, man. Yeah.
What are you rubbish at?
Sim driving.
Excellent.
Oh, brilliant. Well, all right. Do you have any hidden talents that we might not know about? Either, you know, could be completely non-car related.
I mean, I played guitar for 15 years, but more as a sort of thing that I would, on a rainy day, pick it up and have a shred.
Yeah.
You know? So I wouldn't necessarily class it as a talent as such.
What does difficult times at the moment, obviously, but what's the future saying for Mr. JWW on YouTube?
I think, you know, going back to the whole project thing, I really want to just step it up. Every single year I'm trying to do bigger and better projects. So I think the meat of the channel will effectively stay a similar format in that I'm hopefully bringing the audience great insights into the latest, greatest cars and equally some nostalgic stuff with modern classics. But I think around that, it's every year it's about trying to, you know, step it up with various different projects. Another exclusive for you, really. The project I'm working on now go up to number 11. So that's sort of how far we're thinking.
Wow.
That won't be 11 years' time. There'll be a few, you know, each year. But it's all about, you know, trying to evolve the channel to offer things which aren't being offered elsewhere. And ultimately making it, you know, giving solutions and content to the audience, which otherwise don't exist or will improve their sort of viewing experience. So
if someone, you know, like Top Gear or something similar came along and gave you a call and asked you to be a part of it, would you go off and do that?
Yes, but the really important thing here. So I actually had a chat with Top Gear when they went through that big shakeup when Jeremy was punching people. And they lay out very early on that whatever I'm doing now has to stop. So, and then if you think, okay, this might be a Chris Evans situation where you've canned your everything that you've built, your whole YouTube, your brand, everything. You can't associate that anymore. You do Top Gear for a whole year, which is actually 6 episodes. And then second season, they go, sorry about that, mate. Then you've just let your brand die over 6 episodes of nothing.
Yeah.
So I would absolutely do it. And it would be fantastic to do it with the preface that I was still able to keep my YouTube brand going, because it would be suicide not to.
There you are, Top Gear. There's the contract rules. There's the clauses.
There's the terms, non-exclusivity.
Shall we move on to our final three, Harry, old boy?
Let's do it. Do you want to kick off for me?
I'll go.
I always forget which way we do this.
I'm going to go for the middle one first, just to mix it up a little bit. If not YouTubing, what would you be doing?
Watching YouTube.
There's not much money in that, though.
I don't know. I would like to think it was something to do with cars. Although, you know, even though my like sort of number one core love is cars, as mentioned at the very beginning, you know, the revelation of film and editing for me, I'd probably be behind the camera more. Mm-hmm. Probably be producing car content or car shows. Yeah,
I just remembered. Sorry, just going totally off topic. Something just popped into my mind when you mentioned cameras. When we were in Razzlekamer filming, and we got to the top of Jebel Jais, and the sun was going down, and we had the McLaren, the Ferrari, and the W Motors. Yeah. Was it the Lycan or that? And then your camera broke, or you dropped it.
I left it on the roof of the 650S and drove off.
That's right.
And smashed it to bits in the dark at the top of a mountain pass. Oh. And we managed to persuade the police that had closed the road for us to sweep the road with their lights on for me to find it. Imagine that, a 30-mile
road.
Yeah, and we found it. And, that was it.
Rescued the footage.
That video led to 2 million views. It was all on that memory card.
Oh, wow, amazing.
Question number two, over to you.
What's got you excited at the moment?
Coming out of lockdown.
Yeah.
Coming out of lockdown, getting back to a scrap of normality. That's exciting.
Yeah.
Just driving cool cars again. And I mean, you know, as great as it has been being at home, full-time dad and all that sort of jazz, work is, it's more than paying the bills, isn't it? It gives you a sense of worth, and it gives you a sense of purpose. And I think going back out and doing it and creating it feels good, man. Feels good. So sunshine, end of lockdown and cars. That's what I'm excited about.
Awesome.
Nice.
Our third and final three question. Our third and final question of the three questions.
Yeah.
What are you scared of?
Scared of?
You can get as philosophical as you like here, by the way.
Yeah, okay. So I'm gonna say something which is, people are gonna Google this afterwards.
I'm getting my phone ready.
And it turns out this is a real thing. It's called submechanophobia. And it is the fear of machinery submerged in water. So underwater machinery.
So right? Submarines.
Oh, mate, forget it. But like, I think the worst thing would be to fall in like the behind an oil tanker. Like,
that's so specific.
It just scares the hell out of me.
That's putting a laugh in there.
Machinery underwater scares the hell out of me. Yeah.
Wow. Is that just... have you had any experience? Because no, that's just something that's formed in your brain.
Yeah, I don't know. It's something in my brain. I don't know. Yeah, some people don't like spiders. You know.
Yeah.
Because it's got eight legs. I don't know, man. It's just. Yeah.
Wow. I think that's a first for us.
That is definitely a first.
Being completely honest, mate. You know.
Wow. A fear of underwater machinery.
Yeah, it's called submechanophobia.
I mean, to be fair, I wouldn't want to fall behind an oil tanker either.
No, but you could go in a submarine. Would you go in a submarine, wouldn't you, Harry?
Honestly, even just falling into like a commercial docklands, that
worries you.
This is amazing.
Yeah. Very specific. It's very niche.
I like it.
You were probably expecting like crashing my car or something, weren't you? But no.
Really. Well, some people can be very philosophical, but I think that was a nice one. Listen, Mr. JWW, thank you so much for coming on to the Motor Mouth podcast. It's been an absolute pleasure to chat with you.
Thank you so much. It's been brilliant, and hopefully we can see each other face to face at some point.
Thank you so much for listening to the Motor Mouth podcast. Do make sure you give us a follow on our socials, Twitter @MotorMouth_, Instagram @MotorMouth_official, and on Facebook, just search Motor Mouth. You can download the Motor Mouth app, where you can get exclusive video content from MMTV, create your own social profile and interact with others, and check up on all the latest happenings with whatever motorsport takes your fancy. Don't forget to like, subscribe and review. And until next time, you've been listening to the Motor Mouth podcast. We here at Motormouth are a small, independent team. Since starting this podcast just over a year ago, we're reaching over 15,000 of you across 30 countries around the world. And we want to bring the biggest names in motorsport to you. Find out about their lives and careers and have a chat about whatever is going on in the motorsport world. We are determined to carry on producing these episodes. However, they do come at a cost. From securing guests to equipment and editing software and expanding the podcast and app, that's why we've set up a Patreon page where you can help us to carry on doing what we do. There are three levels at which you can contribute, starting from £5 a month to £10 or £20. Each tier allows you slightly different levels of access. Depending on which one you choose, you can enjoy early access to podcast episodes, exclusive member benefits, merchandise, shoutouts, and your chance to feature on one of our shows. Any support you can give us is massively appreciated and will help us grow and continue to bring cool content to race fans all over the world.
Mom deserves the best, and there's no better place to shop for Mother's Day than Whole Foods Market. They're your destination for unbeatable savings, from premium gifts to show-stopping flowers and irresistible desserts. Start by saving 33% with Prime on all body care and candles. Then get a 15-stem bunch of tulips for just $9.99 each with Prime. Round out Mom's menu with festive rosé, irresistible berry chantilly cake, and more special treats. Come celebrate Mother's Day at Whole Foods Market. Mom deserves the best, and there's no better place to shop for Mother's Day than Whole Foods Market. They're your destination for unbeatable savings, from premium gifts to show-stopping flowers and irresistible desserts. Start by saving 33% with Prime on all body care and candles. Then get a 15-stem bunch of tulips for just $9.99 each with Prime. Round out Mom's menu with festive rosé, irresistible berry chantilly cake, and more special treats. Come celebrate Mother's Day at Whole Foods Market.
Hi, this is Craig Robinson from Ways to Win, and support for this podcast comes from Invesco QQQ, the official ETF of the NCAA. The future isn't scary. Not realizing its potential, however, could be. Just like on the recruiting trail, I've seen potential come in many forms as a coach. Learn more at Invesco.com/QQQ. Let's rethink possibility. Invesco Distributors, Inc.